Santa Claus sitting in a sauna by the sea, many majestic modern museums, and fantastic filling food. All this can be yours when you choose Helsinki to host the 2017 World Science Fiction Convention. Where else can you enjoy 17 hours of sunlight while exploring an 18th century island sea fortress? The home of Angry Birds and Linux is calling. Come be a part of the excitement as you enjoy all of this and the World Science Fiction Convention in 2017. Make sure to vote Helsinki in 2017. For more information on how to help Helsinki host the World Science Fiction Convention, please visit www.helsinkiin2017.org.
Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution.
At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T-5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Stiffy and Fanti Show.
I'm Rachel.
And I'm Sean. And we have a special guest today. Special guest is Kat Rambo. Hello, Kat.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. So we're here to talk about a number of things, including your new novel, Beasts of Tibet.
Yes.
Would you tell us a little bit about your new book for folks that are maybe are unfamiliar with it?
Well, I was just, somebody just described it as complex steampunk fantasy for adults. And I think that that's probably a pretty accurate way to describe it. But for people who have read my stories and are familiar with the world that I've been writing a number of them in, Tibet, this is very much part of that. And you will even find that the stories that are outside it, you will find echoes of what's going on, particularly in stories like Prima Flora's Journey, which just appeared in Beneath Ceaseless Skies last month, actually tells the side story of one of the characters that you glimpse early on.
Excellent, excellent. So there are a lot of very interesting things going on in this book. For folks that are maybe familiar with a lot of the short stories, as you say, right, they'll see some connections, obviously because of the mm-hmm. world that we're dealing with. And I did think it was very interesting that you titled the novel Beasts of Tibet, given the position that the various beasts, I guess you could say that's a somewhat loose definition mm-hmm. we could use, the position that they have in the culture that were presented, particularly in the city of Tibet. And so I wanted to talk about that first, because essentially humans are the only ones in that were presented with in a position of power. Mm-hmm. And everyone else is to varying degrees either slaves or exterminated, mm-hmm. depending on what they are. Right. I hope you could talk a little bit about that and kind of the design of a world structured so clearly on the backs of slavers.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think so. This world grew out of a particular story. And that is a story that appeared in Clark's World magazine called I'll Gnaw Your Bones, the Manticore said, where it was a traveling circus, where there was a manticore who was in that position. And a lot of it was sort of implicit in the story. And that world kept pulling me back. And one of the reasons was that I did want to talk specifically about questions of power and oppression and very much what we do, what the power group does to those we oppress. Because my feeling is in looking at history that we do two things. And one is that we infantilize them and we position them as these creatures that we need to care for because otherwise they will come to harm because of their, you know, innate natures. And we demonize them, right? We create, they then become the other, right? They're the thing to be frightened by. And so I did want to speak specifically about that. And I also wanted to write cool books with mythological creatures in it. You know, And I'm very much interested in sort of the social anthropology side of things. But at the same time, I also wanted to tell a kind of really interesting, cool story.
Yeah, so to dig into that a little bit more, mm-hmm. there's a very complex slave-type system in Tibet. Mm-hmm. I think one of the interesting sort of side conversations we have, I think, is with the Duke, where he's talking about, how hard it is to keep unicorns because they don't do well in captivity. They essentially destroy themselves mm-hmm. when they're sort of penned up, which I thought was a really interesting way of kind of presenting this super mythical creature, this creature that everyone who's writing sort of fairy tales at some point brings up. But in bringing it up in the context of domestication, and that's a thing that happens with numerous other creatures, right, that you mm-hmm. kind of explored. And I was curious about that in particular, the kind of domestication, the attempts to create people or to manipulate these creatures into beasts of burden, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is there a question?
It's more more kind of a comment leading to a kind of conversation about the domestication, yeah.
Yeah, so one of the things that I'm going back to in these is a series of books that really influenced me because I hit them as a teenager, and they were by Thomas Burnett Swan, and they were slim little books that took mythological creatures and made them the protagonists. And I was just fascinated by those books, and I loved those books. I mean, I still have them packed away. I will never part with them. So I wanted to do something with that. And, honestly, maybe it is cynical of me, but I do think that human beings in this position would be like, oh, there's a very small number of these beasts. And if we have them in this order, we can take advantage of them, which is exactly what, it's what the whites, what the people. I want to be very careful about what I say here, but I do think, historically speaking, the Europeans went over to Africa and gleefully brought people over to the Americas and created a system to justify that. And so I think, I think that in a system where there are beasts, I mean, one of the things you will notice is that that's built into the religions, right? And it's built into everybody's like, everybody knows beasts, it's their nature. And in fact, this is going to go become even more important in the second book, where you have several characters that have a different relationship to the beast than Bella or Teo, who is, sort of a borderline beast.
Yeah, it's an interesting point. Rachel, you wanted to jump in here.
Well, not quite on the domestication point, but one of the things that I found most striking was actually the idea that the city runs on not just this culture of slavery, which, there is that complex thing about economies running on unpaid labor and all that, but it's actually the fact that they burn dryads.
Right. And if you, I did a bunch of little flash pieces that if you go on my website and go to the Tibet section, there's, I think, a dozen or so of them. And one of them is actually a treatise by a character who's going to come up in book two that is about basically kind of, with magical creatures, even after they die, we use them. We have these oracular pigs that the affluent households keep. And as soon as those pigs die, we eat them. Sometimes we kill them and eat them. I took it one step further, right? We're not just enslaving this group, but eating them. But I think that's a really interesting concept, because one of the things that I think science fiction and fantasy does is this idea of literalizing the metaphor. Taking a figure of speech and sort of making eyes literally drop to the floor, or, having people actually turn invisible. And to me, the idea that the rich eat the poor is an interesting and somewhat true one. And so it's interesting to pull it into the narrative in this way, if that makes sense.
Sure, yeah. Richard, do you have another question on this?
I was mostly, I guess the reason I found the dryads in particular so striking was the fact that it was commented on that, you know, they were someday we're going to run out of dryads. And I felt like there was kind of like, you know, a little environmentalist thread running through there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the story in Beneath Ceaseless Skies is the story of one of those dryads.
Oh.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and actually you will see her appear again in book two.
I have to make sure to read this story.
That's it. That's it.
That's
one of the really interesting things about writing this book, you know, cause I've been writing this book in one form or another since 2005. And one of the things that I found at one point when I went back to it after kind of stopping and writing another project and coming back to it was that the short stories that I had been writing all along, that I had been starting in 2005 with On All Your Bones, The Man of Course Said, that this book, they all tied into this book in one way or another. And not all of them, but a number of them, about half of them. And so it's been kind of fascinating to me, you know, because it's almost as though there is this fifth book in the quartet, which is sort of the volume of the stories.
Sure, sure. It is very interesting. I mean, Rachel brought up a very excellent point that there is a kind of an environmental angle to this, and I think your novel deals with the complexities of power dynamics really remarkably well. It not just does so through the literal beast, but as you mentioned earlier, your main character, Tio, is a beast of a sort. We mm-hmm. learn pretty much from the start that he is a shapeshifter by blood, although he is incapable of shifting, mm-hmm. As far as we know, because mm-hmm. of circumstances, which I'm not going to go into. But he, of course, is presented in another... He presents another power dynamic, which is that mm-hmm. from the very start, his family sends him or essentially like gifts him to the religious sect that is in mm-hmm. Tibet. So he's mm-hmm. going to become an acolyte of this religious sect, presumably entirely against his will. Mm-hmm. And that creates, of course, a number of conflicts very early on in the novel with power. And I'm curious, you know, because Tio is such a young character, and he is outcast in two ways. First, because he can't talk about what he is outside of his community. And second, because within his community, he's kind of a weirdo or...
Right, he's a failure.
Yeah, exactly. You know, talking about and thinking about, you know, using a young character as the kind of the center point of that degree of conflict, that massive sense of being... removed from every culture possible because you can never fully be yourself. And I was curious what your desire to do so with such a young character was and kind of designing that.
Well, I wanted Tao to be a young character and that I wanted him to be a fairly naive character, right? He's a boy who's sort of grown up on these sort of overblown stories that have sort of filtered from Tibet via newsprint, you know, via what they call the pennywides, which have been sort of wadded up and used to pack stuff. I wanted him to be naive, and I also wanted him to be powerless, right? Because I think that's one of the things that is. That's one of the things that we come to fiction for, is to find out, you know, how people react to certain situations, right? You know, so how do people react to situations where they're powerless? What happens if we decide to, you know, take our fate in our own hands? And Tao is extra interesting to me because, you know, the position of a shifter is one that's hated by both sides, right? The humans hate the shifters because they can be beasts in disguise, while the beasts hate the shifters because they can pretend to be humans. And, you know, that's a very interesting power dynamic that I wanted to explore, and which will come up again and again in the course of the book, because I think that idea of assuming an identity in order to take on the power that comes with it is an interesting one.
Well, and we see that as well with Bella and the whole, the gladiatorial combat, which I found very interesting.
Before we jump to that, because Rachel, I think we should definitely talk about Bella Canto. I'm curious, Kat, you know, because you're talking about the fear that is evoked by shapeshifters, by, you know, everyone around them, and I'm curious if you were conscious of sort of playing with the historical idea of passing.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I was thinking of one of the texts that I read in college, one that I think is very interesting and is one of the books that I go to every once in a while, is Nella Larsen's Passing.
Yes.
Which is a wonderful book, wonderful book. I mean, and that's, you know, that's such an interesting question. And particularly nowadays, right, when you can take on an identity online. And that's, you know, boy, is that interesting. I mean, just all sorts of questions come up with that.
Have you read George Schuyler's Black No More, perchance?
I don't think I have. I'm writing that down. It's something that I will.
I really, really, really okay. Recommend it.
Cool.
Yeah.
Cool.
It deals with this in a somewhat satirical way.
Oh, interesting.
A kind of science fictional premise.
So, okay. Okay. Yeah. Cool.
He's a Harlem Renaissance writer. So.
Oh, nice. All right.
Larson. Yeah. So, and for folks listening, definitely recommend it. It's one of my favorite novels of the Harlem Renaissance period. It's genius. Also, Nella Larsen's Passing is wonderful.
So
Rachel, I suspect you've got some questions about the lead us to Bella Canto, because I think that would be another very interesting thing to discuss here.
Well, I mean, the whole character of Bella was extremely interesting to me as, I mean, a woman that in many ways, she said a lot of things that you would almost expect more classically out of a male character. So I found that extremely, you know, it was very dear to my heart, particularly that she was a gladiator and all that. But I was actually very kind of curious about the issues with sexuality that you explored with her, and kind of what led you to deciding to kind of go in that direction with her. Cause I loved it.
Well, so two things about Bella. And one is that this book was very much a different form when I first started writing, and it was a YA set in the Brides of Steel, and it followed two students. And then sort of in the middle of writing that, Bella Canto sort of swaggered in as one of the instructors. And I was like, oh, okay, this is interesting. And then just sort of, well, there was a point where I had been banging my head against the book for a while. And my husband said, you know, is it possible you are writing the wrong book? And I was like, oh, shit, yes, it's Bella Canto's story. To some extent, I'm going to kind of fall back on sort of classic chicken author move, which is that, you know, kind of she shaped herself, you know. That said, she, you know, she's a kind of heroine that I want to read about. She is charismatic. She is arrogant, not in a way that leads her to be cruel, but in a sort of, you know, honey badger don't give a fuck sort of way. And, you know, and she's having a lot of sex and she likes it, you know, and she's middle-aged too. Right. She's the character that I wanted to read about. And she's a character that I have not seen a lot of in speculative fiction. Louise McMaster Bouchold has The Curse of Chalion, has a older female character there. And I like that. And C.J. Cherry's Channer series has an older kind of middle-aged female captain who happens to be a feline. But really, there's not that many of them. But I wanted a character. I wanted a character with some swagger to her. And I wanted somebody, you know, I wanted somebody that readers could love.
Interesting. You know, she does have that swagger, mm-hmm. which I found was so fun. She's very confident in her abilities. By this point, justifiably so, I think. given how many times she has remained undefeated. Mm-hmm. And I did think it was very interesting, her relationship with her students in particular, mm-hmm. or potential students. Mm-hmm. The way in which she sort of perceives potential out of students versus ones where she just thinks they're not going to succeed. She has that kind of that arrogance, but also a bit of that. She has a sense of what really makes a great fighter, and it's not right. something that's just strictly technical. There's right. something about the person that matters, as in her case, right?
Right, right. And that's one of the things I like about her is she's very uncompromising in how she judges people, but the set of standards that she holds them to is one that she has matched, right? You know, she's somebody who has, you know, come up through sheer force of will. And that's, you know, one of the things I really enjoy reading. I think it's the second chapter in which she appears, because one of the things she does in it, if I'm remembering correctly, and of course the book is just this blur to me at this moment, but it's when she's talking about when she first came to the Brides of Steel, and she says quite honestly, it wasn't my talent that made them let me in. It was the fact that I would not give up, and that I kept, you know, they kept throwing people at me, and I was just like, okay, one more time.
Yeah, yeah. I want to jump to something related to her, which is the somewhat humorous idea, or at least I interpret it somewhat humorously, that her participation in gladiatorial combat is essentially like Groundhog Day.
Yes.
Which I thought was really amusing, and yet it's also part of what produces a great deal of resentment, because
right.
This is revealed, I think, in the second chapter, that she's playing the character of Winter, and every time she wins, Winter stays, like each season is just a couple weeks longer, like with, you know, Groundhog
right.
Day.
6 weeks.
It's 6 weeks longer. Yeah, yeah. And it produces a great deal of resentment.
Yes.
People
yes.
hate her. They're like, enough with the frickin' Winter.
Well, you think about it. I mean, that would have economic consequences, right? I mean, that's for particularly if you are not affluent, that's a kind of crappy thing. You've got 6 more weeks of, you know, getting fuel and keeping warm and all of that. But yeah, it did start with a kind of groundhoggy sort of idea. And one of my fears has been that you know, people get so amused by that they get bounced out of the story.
Oh, it didn't do so for me. I mean, I recognized what was kind of happening, but mm-hmm. it seemed to me that a world with, if I recall correctly, has 3 moons.
Right.
It's full of mystical creatures.
Right.
That it would make sense that there would be additional magical qualities to its mm-hmm. seasons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I actually thought that putting her in that role gave this extra layer of, I mean, there are so many layers to this novel, which is, you know, amazing, but it's the fact that everyone loves her because she is like this champion and everyone loves a winner. But at the same time, people are also really starting to get tired of her because, you know, so you want to cheer for the champion, but then if you cheer for her, that also means that you're going to get more Winter and nobody likes more Winter. So it started building up to this very, like, complex love-hate thing. And then, you know, you brought in the whole idea of everyone wants her to retire because she's not going to throw a match. And, you know, it's so wound up in her identity that you can't really imagine her ever retiring either.
Nobody stepped aside for me, so why should I step aside for someone else?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah, yeah.
I did really enjoy that about her character because it gives a sense of, you know, she takes her position more seriously than just like we're fighting, right? That this is, I don't think she puts it in these terms, but it's about kind of a personal honor or pride mm-hmm. in oneself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, the other interesting thing too, unless Rachel, you have a question specific to this, that's bouncing off this. Okay. Well, one of the interesting things that we learn from, Teo is that he knows about Bellacanto because of these pulpy novels that he reads.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically like dime style novels. They're about her grandiose adventures and successes as the great gladiator. And I really, I loved that element, because it gave this kind of, this grandiosity to something that is already grandiose, right? It's this, mm-hmm. it's this big ceremony. It's a massive feature. And we get to see the degree to which it kind of becomes more and more mythologized as it stretches out and out further from the city. And I'm curious, you know, what was the desire or the interest in sort of placing these dime novels in not just about her, but also in sort of Teo's life? I mean, what was the kind of idea behind that?
Well, there's two things going on there. And one is that, you know, I grew up reading epic fantasy, and I love epic fantasy. And so in some ways, it's kind of my tribute to a lot of those stories. But it's also, it's kind of a metafictional touch, right? It's a kind of like, here we are in a fantasy story that is also about fantasy stories. And in the second book that I'm working on right now, in fact, one of the point of view characters is Adelina, who is Bella's friend and also the publisher of all and writer of all of those novels. So I'm going to do more with that.
That's going to be fun.
Yeah. Yeah.
Have you considered writing a Bella Canto pulp novel?
Oh, God, I hadn't. That might be kind of fun. Actually, it might be fun to do. I could do a short story. Yes,
that would be so much fun.
That would be so much fun, yeah. I mean, and that was like another, you know, you had that kind of the thing with identity in there. And kind of, was that just part of sort of the steampunk kind of ethos that you were trying to bring into it? Or what particularly made you decide you wanted to have that kind of...
The Pennywise?
Yeah, the Pennywise and the wonderfully fictionalized adventures written by her friend.
I was having fun with it at that point, I think, as much as anything else. And if you look at the little flash pieces that I mentioned on the website, those were actually all in the novel at one point. And quite honestly, it was me going, ooh, I'm going to do something fun with this. But they're very useful because what they are, they're entries to guide. Most of them are entries to a guidebook, various guidebooks to Tibet produced by Spinner Press.
Excellent, excellent. Rachel, you got another question?
Oh, actually, no. I already mentioned like the thing with Bella Canto's sexuality. Is she more bisexual or more a lesbian? Because sometimes
she's
bisexual. That makes me so happy.
Yeah, yeah. There's enough bisexual characters in literature that aren't broken in some way, and I get very tired of it. Actually, I went to Emerald City Comic Con. And John Barrowman was there, and I actually stood in line for fucking 2 hours just to be able to give him a copy of the book. And I'm sure he didn't notice. It's probably, you know, vanished immediately. But Captain Jack of Torchwood was one of the characters, I think, that influenced Bella Canto.
Interesting. Well, I mean, he is
unabashed. Just he like is, Bella, right?
Yeah, I mean, he does. He male, female, with tentacles, that's doesn't it? Matter.
Well, yeah. I mean, the only reason I wasn't 100%, because I was pretty sure that she was bisexual, and I was, like, super happy about that, because, yeah, I share your opinion that there are not enough bisexual characters. It was mostly, you know, most of the relationships we kind of get an impression from her about are with women, and then she's got her one with the Duke, and you get that's more something that she's kind of doing.
Yeah, that's just, more about duty than anything else. But no, she is, at least in my head, entirely.
But actually, she does kind of get a little bit of that Captain Jack, like, kind of pansexuality going, because she had her thing with the centaur.
Who was male.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a, yeah.
Thank you so much.
Well, this is fun. Well, on this subject, because you brought it up, that there aren't a lot of positive portrayals of bisexual people in science fiction and fantasy, probably in general, but I can't speak too much outside of that field. And just as a guess, or if you have an expert opinion, why do you think that is?
The thing that I will say, and this is you know, in some ways, the bisexuals, at least in my experience, because it is an identity that I place myself in, that we are kind of the shifters of the sexual world. I mean, it's kind of like the gay folks are like, well, you can pass for heterosexual, and the heterosexual, you can, you know, it just sort of, that is one of them. And I think it's a smaller percentage overall, perhaps, of the overall population.
We're kind of like the shifters of the LGBT community.
That's it, exactly. That's it. You know, like, well, you guys, you know, because I'm married to a man, so I can enjoy heterosexual privilege. Not that it's a question that comes up that much in my life, but I mean, you know, we had no trouble getting married. I took his name because I liked it so much better than my surname.
That is interesting. And it is, I mean, you're right, because, I mean, we're living in a radically changing society where mm-hmm. different kinds of, well, some degree of different kinds of sexual relationship are becoming more acceptable. I mean, others right. are perhaps less acceptable still.
Bear in mind that I am now, I've reached the advanced age of 50, which just seems surreal to me. But I mean, like, when I was growing up, when I was in high school, I had no idea kind of what homosexuality was, except that I read those Thomas Burnett Swan books, which often featured same-sex relationships. But I had no idea there was a name for it or anything like that. And trans folk were just absolutely, you know, viewed much more, I think. I mean, I think still there are a lot of issues, but I they're not invisible the way they used to be, which I think is definitely a step forward.
Yeah, there's certainly some truth to that. I mean, I'm in Florida, an interesting thing. I think it got struck down, but I'm not 100% sure. There's a bill passing around in Florida regarding trans people and bathrooms.
And bathrooms, yeah, I read about that. And that's, but when I was growing up, that would have just automatically sort of fallen into the category of a sex crime. Going to being in the wrong bathroom and probably would have led to an arrest and being noted as a sexual offender.
God, that's really terrifying. Yeah. I wonder if, you know, because as soon as, like, there seemed to be a push for gay people to get, like, marriage rights, all of a sudden there are these bills everywhere to ban gay marriage. And, you know, now that transgender people are sort of pushing to have their rights better recognized by the state, there seem to be these, again, the same kind of pushback. You know, we're going to make laws that ban your ability to do so. I wonder if that is... that's just a cyclical thing that occurs, that, what, you know, as long as people are quiet, like, there'll be laws that kind of are in place, but that the state doesn't, like, people don't use the state as a mechanism to sort of continue smashing, because it's already, I guess, smashed. Right. And that as soon as they become visible, people say, no, we need to use the state to smash it. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning, I guess, of the end of an ideology, because as we know now, 36 of the 50 states in the United States allow gay marriage whether they want to or not.
right. And I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I there is this inevitable backlash that happens. And we saw it happen in the 70s with feminism. And, you know, and actually I would argue that there are some places where the pendulum has swung back so hard and aggressively, like toy stores. You know, when I was a kid going through toy stores, while aisles were gendered, there wasn't this sort of aggressively pink versus blue thing that happens right now. And nowadays, it's very surreal, actually, to go through toy stores. It seems to me toys are much more gendered than they used to be, which is kind of crappy. I mean, not that they weren't in the first place. I mean, there's always been easy bake ovens aimed at little girls and bulldozers at little boys. But nowadays, it's weird. Like, they'll be the bulldozers, but the ones for the girls are pink and have rhinestones on them. You know, so what's that about? That's just weird.
Yeah, and it's something that has been not a hot topic, but a topic that's been discussed is, you know, we have the Avengers and the main female superhero
and that doesn't
have her own toy.
Don't even get me started on the fucking Avengers. I love superhero stuff. I have been a comic book reader since you know early days, and I love the Avengers and I love the Defenders. I love a lot of them. I know the Marvel Universe up until about the mid 80s when I finally kind of said, "Oh my God, these are eating a lot of my spare money," and kind of quit cold turkey. It just breaks my heart that Avengers movie could have had, you know, first a. The only we get Black Widow, and I haven't seen the movie yet. Okay, so I'm speaking from a position of utter ignorance, but the fact that it's just the Black Widow pisses me off. There's so many people they could have brought in,
and I'm still not irritating. I'm still not over the fact that we've got Ant-Man and no Wasp.
Yes, what the fuck is that about? Yeah, as you could tell, I am invested in this discussion. You know, and I'm happy. I love the fact that superhero movies have gotten to the place where there are superhero movies. I go to them like Captain America, the Winter Soldier. I'm just like, yes, yes, yes. This is awesome. But please, could I maybe have a POV character in there once in a while that has some actual fucking superpowers? I'm sorry if I'm swearing so much. I just, bleh.
It's okay.
Okay.
This conversation has come up three times in the last couple of days that we just need a damn Black Widow movie.
That'd be a lot of fun.
And it is interesting because I wonder, you know, the CEOs of Marvel keep saying we don't want to do a female superhero movie, but they're doing Captain Marvel. So clearly whoever the CEO is, he doesn't have power. Yeah, I know, but hold on. Because I wonder if part of the reason they haven't done a Black Widow movie is because Scarlett Johansson can't do it because she's not on the same commitment level that the men who have trilogies are, because I mean their schedules are like fucked.
Right.
Captain America's in like 8,000 movies in the next 6 months. So I wonder if that has something to do with it, or if it's just that the studio just doesn't want to do it. And if it's the latter, shame on them. If it's the former, that sucks. And I don't know what we would do. But
there are female superheroes that they could do. And when you look at the, I'm going to admit I haven't been following Archer or Green Arrow or whatever it is. But I did follow like Smallville somewhat religiously. There's a lot of and I know that's DC. Sorry, there's female characters that could be used that aren't in all of these. You know, there's actually, if you go and look, there are cool. I mean, Spider-Woman. Oh, I believe her name was, I'm Jessica something or other. The happy-go-lucky Hellcat. You could do Defenders and kind of focusing on Hellcat. That'd be awesome. And just, you know, why isn't anybody writing those? Coop.
They probably can't do Spider-Woman because I don't know how much control Sony has over the Spider-Verse. And so that may be a Sony thing, not a Marvel Studios thing. But you're right that there are other female characters they could do.
Yeah.
I mean, there are Avengers who are women. I mean, they do. Mm-hmm. We do have Scarlet Witch.
Mm-hmm.
Which is nice. I don't think they're going to give her own movie.
No.
But there are other female characters they could do.
Ms. Marvel.
Oh my gosh. I would kill for Ms. Marvel. I mean, I realize that they probably are going to, like, they'll do a teaser at the end of the Captain Marvel movie where they introduce her, but made a Ms. Marvel movie, I would go to that like 100 times.
I would be happy to see a Carol Danvers version, or I would be happy to see one based on the one that G. Willow Wilson is writing right now. Either of those would make me so happy.
I'm pretty sure we're getting the Carol Danvers version in 2019.
Well, that's when we're getting, I think it's going to be Captain Marvel rather than.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
Yeah. It'll probably be Carol Danvers, and if they're smart, they'll cast Katie Sackhoff. It would be good.
I need a moment.
Fan yourself.
She would be such a good Captain Marvel. Oh, okay. All right. We're totally geeking out about the time when we take over Marvel and we make it the greatest Marvel studio ever. when there's amazing characters. Oh, that would be great. But in any case, we should switch tracks a little bit because I mentioned off podcast that I did want to talk to you about your writing classes.
Oh, yeah.
So you do run a whole number of writing classes, but I did want to talk just more generally about some of the things that you do with writing classes, and particularly like kind of writing related questions that you might want to answer. Okay. And so the first question I actually had was, what are some of the common challenges you find that your students face?
I find that they have trouble setting up a story beginning that pulls a reader in and tells the reader that they can relax and just enjoy the story, which is something that you really need to do in the first few paragraphs and are often the only things that the editor are looking at, right? Speaking as an editor, I could look at those first few paragraphs and go, I do want to read further, or boy, I'm done. I'm trying to think of other, one of the things that I've been doing is my classes when I create new ones, and I do create new ones sort of every few months just because it gets boring to teach the same stuff over and over again, usually reflects either a question that somebody's asked or something that I've been working on. And so one of the things that I've been thinking about lately is a point of view and getting inside your character's head. So I'm kind of figuring on doing a class on that in the next batch. And one of the reasons that I like doing that is it makes me kind of write out, I have to kind of figure out a 2-hour outline for a class. And in doing so, I've got to articulate a lot of my own thoughts. And that's very helpful to me as a writer.
What about, yourself as somebody creating writing classes? And as you said, right, you kind of cycle through different ideas so that you mm-hmm. can keep it fresh for you.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the difficulties you personally have had in sort of running writing classes of various kinds?
Well, one is that, I teach, for example, the 6-week story class, and I worry sometimes that when I'm teaching it, I feel like, oh my God, I've said this before. And it's true. I have said it before, and I've said it before, a couple dozen times, but not to those folks. So that sort of fighting off that nagging, oh my God, they're sitting there listening to you repeat yourself over and over again, feeling is a big one. Other than that, I love doing the writing classes. They're just a lot of fun, mainly because there's a lot of writing exercises that go on. And so hearing what people do with the various writing prompts and writing exercises is, it's really sort of exhilarating and energizing to see how many directions people can go in. And at the same time, see over and over again, the amazing things that people deliver when they're willing to sort of, just sit down and write. And so one of the things that I love about the classes is you see over the course of a couple of hours, people learning to trust themselves a little bit more. And being like, oh, holy shit, these first two exercises, I sat down and I did them and wow, there was some good stuff in them. And hey, that second one might actually be the part of a flash piece. It's just really fun to watch.
It's wonderful. Wonderful. Rachel?
Well, I was just wondering, where has your focus always more been, kind of short fiction, or were you more starting on novels and you kind of ended up in short fiction? Because you have a lot of really good short fiction out there.
Well, when I came through grad school, because I went through Johns Hopkins, the writing seminars there, and I did I was writing a lot of short stories, but I also produced a novel about superheroes. So I've always kind of been doing both, I guess. When I came through Clarion West, they kept telling us, we'd go to the parties and it'd be like people sort of back you in a corner and be like, oh, some people don't write at all after Clarion West. And you'd be like, get away from me. And so immediately after Clarion West, I felt compelled to keep writing a short story a week, despite the fact I was working on a novel as well. And so I'm very prolific, I guess. So I do both. Does that answer your question at all?
No, hey, you swing both ways. That's fine. I'm friendly to that here.
That's it, exactly. And that's, you know, I do. I it's been really interesting to me. Short stories are a lot of fun, and I love writing short stories. And one of the things I like about them is often you can sit down at the keyboard and write one and finish it. And whereas with a novel, you sit down and you write a big chunk of words and you're still not done. But at the same time, novels have room to do so much in terms of, you know, here's plot arcs, and, you know, not just plot arcs for characters, but like Tabat, the city has its own plot arc that's going on, and some of the locations in it have plot arcs that are going on, and that's just fascinating, you know. So it's not like a novel is a longer short story, it's more like a short story cubed.
Yeah, very different structure. Yeah, I mean, it's something I think a lot of people will say when, you know, they're asked, why do you like short fiction or why do you like novels? Well, they each offer their own pros and cons, as it were, right? They're useful for different kinds of stories. I don't think you could tell Beasts of Tabat in 500 words or 5,000. You just couldn't cram, you couldn't simplify it into that space. So, yeah. Well, I'm curious, because Rachel had brought up, you know, your past work. I mean, you've been writing short fiction and publishing short fiction, I think, as far back as 1990, if I recall correctly. And I'm curious, as you know, I'm a budding wannabe writer, and Rachel is not a wannabe, and there may be budding writers on here, but but as somebody who has been writing for 20 something years, do you ever look back at your older work and kind of see how you have changed, what you learned through the process of writing and publishing?
Sure. I was just looking at a story that I wrote when I was in grad school called The Accordion, which actually I love reading because it's got a little device in it that makes people laugh. Yeah, I look back at them and sometimes I see stuff and I think, I would do that differently now. But I still look back at them with pleasure. I think, I'm trying to think if there's any that I'm embarrassed by right now. And no, there's some that are simpler than others, but I'm still pretty pleased with them.
You're lucky. I've got a couple I would never let see the light of day.
Oh, well, but you know, I have stuff. Are we talking about stuff that we didn't publish? Cause in that case, sure. I've got some stuff where I'm like, yeah, plenty of that stuff. Sure. I've got poetry. That poetry will never go online or out into the world. Cause it's at the emo poetry of it.
You had that phase too.
Oh no.
Cryptic nuances and God.
I have so many composition books full of just the most angsty, depressing emo poetry.
Yeah.
Me too.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh my God. I look back at it sometimes and just think, what the hell was wrong with me?
But that's, you know, I mean, we all go through that. That's, I mean, one of the things I was kind of laughing at is one of the advantages I feel like I've had is that the internet was not around when I was a teenager. So none of that is recorded.
Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
Excellent. And so for our last question, Kat, what is the one big piece of advice that you wish you had known when you first started writing?
Oh, wow. When I first started, I think part of it is something that I stumbled into, but which I wish kind of people had said to me from the beginning, is simply butt in chair and sending stuff out. Which is a sort of two-part thing. But, you know, one of the things that happens when we begin thinking of ourselves as writers is that often one form of handy procrastination is posturing about being a writer as opposed to writing. So the one piece of advice that honestly, this is one of the catchphrases around Shea Rambo, is writers just fucking write. And I think that is really important. And I think that's very applicable to nowadays when there is a great deal of controversy going on. And I see 5,000 word blog posts going about various things. And I think, boy, that's 5,000 words of fiction that just never going to get written. And I know people say, boy, that's a different part of my head or whatever, but just, boy, that's time people put into that. And so, you know, writers just write. And I think that is the most important thing.
That's a fair piece of advice. Well, so folks can find Beasts of Tibet at this moment, because it's out, it's in the world, it can be purchased basically anywhere, I think, at this point, except the moon. Well, no, you might be able to. Can you get the internet on the moon?
Probably. Okay. I when it's in the right phase, or depending on where you are, which phase and all of that, yeah.
Do you think the people on the International Space Station have, like, Kindles and they buy books while they're up there, or...
Oh my gosh, what a great question. I don't know. I would think that Amazon is missing a publicity possibility if they don't.
That would be cool, right?
That'd be cool. That would be cool. That's worth pursuing. Sifla could sponsor a special sci-fi to the space station program.
Excellent. So we know you're working on the second novel.
Mm-hmm.
But what else do you have coming out, or if you're doing any kind of convention appearances you'd like to let people know about the next few months?
I will be at Phoenix Comic Con at the end of May. I will be at the Nebula weekend at the beginning of June. I will be at Gen Con this summer, which I'm very excited about because I haven't been to Gen Con since I was, I think, 16 years old. I'm doing Worldcon. I have a story recently out in Black Guards, which is an anthology about sort of rogues and adventurers. And if you like that story, one of its characters is appearing later this year in Beneath Ceaseless Skies. And that's pretty much it.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Kat, for coming on and talking to us about your book and your writing courses, and for having a little bit of a squee, anger, ranty festival about Marvel movies.
Anytime. It's always fun talking with you guys. I'm always happy to do it.
Excellent. Well, I suspect we're going to have you on again, because Rachel came up with some ideas during our conversation for panels, so you'll be hearing from us.
Well, I do have, this fall, we're doing a second one of those two-sided collections, this time aimed at fantasy stuff. So last time it was Near Plus Far. This time it's Neither Here Nor There. So it'll be a secondary world fantasy on one side and fantasy set on our own world in the other.
Oh, that'll be really cool.
Fun. It's going to be really fun. And the same publisher, Hydra House. Really excited about that.
Well, excellent. So for folks that are waiting on something new to read, you can check out Beasts of Tibet right now. So go buy 8,000 copies and distribute them to your friends. And then make them buy 8,000 copies.
There you go.
Yeah. And soon it'll be like a pyramid, you know, to just keep growing.
That's it.
Yeah. Perfect. Well, thanks again, Kat.
Appreciate it. Take care, you guys.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Pass in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley. Last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.